This is surviving parenting without going gray bald or completely insane. A friend of mine and I came up with this title. He's a pastor at a church in North Carolina. And he wanted me to do some parenting workshops. He goes, Pete, I want something that, a different kind of title. So this is what we came up with. And I've used this title and for numerous workshops, but it's different each time that I do it. My disclaimers. I am not a parent. I do not have kids. I see things more from a parent, from a child's perspective, than I do from the parent perspective. I've talked to lots of parents, and in here, I hear what's going on with parents, and in my head, I understand, but not in my heart. And that is something for you to make sure you keep in mind as we're going through this, because as a parent, your perspective of having a child, you have something that I do not have as far as that experience and all. And keep that in mind as we're going through this. People are sometimes like, well, just tell me what to do, Pete. I'm like, you really want me to tell you what to do? It's like, I don't see these workshops as me coming across and telling you, oh, well, if you just do these things, everything is just going to be fine. Because I don't have those kind of answers. But collectively, as a group of parents, we do have a lot of answers in here. And so I see it, my job is kind of helping you to generate. You're going to need chairs if you want to sit down. Okay. Peanut gallery in the back there? Literally, yes. Okay, very good. And so it's my job to kind of provide a framework or a structure whereby information can be generated from you as a group. And as you start talking with each other and here, making connections with each other that continue outside of here. This is just the starting point of this kind of stuff. This is not the place to get the answers kind of stuff. All right, so getting started. I'm going to go through with you a little bit of child development. All the theorists on child development would probably roll over in their graves. Those that are dead because of what I'm about to do. But I'm trying to look at this, what seems to make sense, when I'm working with parents and talking with them as far as what to keep in mind with their children. All right. As I run out of ink here. Okay. Now, I think in pictures and graphically kind of doing stuff. And I also think in building things. I like to build things. And so that's the way I kind of think. And so when I think of the beginning stages as far as like child development, she knows here. Okay. If you look about from age 0 to 3, the biggest task, the biggest role for children to master at that point, from those ages in there, is how to be able to trust. The whole issue of trust goes on, and it happens in many different ways. Every time a child, 0-3, is cold, you got an infant that is cold, and you recognize this child is cold, and you hold them, or you get some warm clothes on them, what happens is the process of, let's see, a child has a need. That need, has an infant express a need? Yes, okay. Some kind of a tantrum. Like they just, it's kind of like, and if that need is met, then what happens is that trust increases, but then you go right back to a need again. And so you have this cycle in this stage here that's going on all the time. Whenever a need is not met, it can erode away at trust. When a child is hungry and needs to eat, and they go for a long period of time and that need is not met, it's hard for them to be able then to trust. Again, this is repeated like thousands of times. A child that just needs to be held, just held. They're not hungry, their diaper doesn't need to be changed, they're not hungry, they're not cold, they just need to be held. That's their need. And when that is met, trust starts building. And you notice this is the foundation here. Without this trust being built down here, everything else that happens to a child for the rest of their lives is severely affected. It's like when I meet with a family for the first time, and I ask them for a history. I say, what was this kid like as an infant? And the parents say, he's like, he never wanted to, or she never wanted to be held. I'm like, what kind of an infant doesn't want to be held? Okay. So somewhere along here, something happened where the needs weren't being met. Either the parents weren't able to because of what they were going through at the time, or the child would get in such of a tantrum at times, it was hard to get them settled down, but it's possible to settle a child down eventually. But whatever it was, it got in the way of building the trust. That's going to be some significant problems as they grow. All right. So, let's see. The next stage. All right. Here you get this wonderful baby. Everything's kind of going fine and everything. And you're going from, these ages are very rough kind of stuff, and they definitely do overlap because trust continues actually throughout. But this is where the major foundation of it, okay? We're gonna look at here, separation type of issues. And like, wait a minute, already? It's like, I just got this kid. You know, you already want me to work on the separation kind of stuff. And actually, separation does begin back here. No, you remember it's interesting to watch, the kids around here also, the little ones, that, where those that have the trust is built and is there with their parent, they can, they teeter off and they can go away from their parent as long as they can see them. Okay? They've got that kind of trust. And it, as being curious, and especially following the chipmunk. You ever seen following the chipmunks?
Yeah.
and they turn around, and their parent left them. Well, not actually, but they're around the corner, and they can't see their parent. But in their mind, their parent left them. Okay. And so then, what happens is that you get into this stage. You have the needs to continues to go on, but you also have now wants. I love it when, especially teenagers, well, I need some new clothes, Mom. Okay, so you get to the want, and when you get into this age, again, you still have tantrums, and you come down here, and instead of it always being met or giving them what they want, there's limit setting. By doing the limit setting, what's possible is mutual fun. Building the relationship with your child then. Without the limit setting, every child needs lots of limits. Because otherwise, they're kind of like, everywhere. The limit setting is a need that they have. Without it, children initially are like, yes, kind of stuff. And on the other side, it's like, oh, this is kind of scary. But I like it, but it's scary. And so what do? The like side wins out. And then what happens is, as a parent, you're getting frustrated because there are no limit setting that's going on. This is, let's see. Are you familiar with the German Shepherd commands? Okay, let's see if I can go through this. I'll put this over the side here. Let's see, about 0 to 3, the German Shepherd commands, all you need to do is basically showing love for a child. I mean, it's putting it very simply and oversimplifying it, but that's what you're looking at doing. Once they get to the age 3 and 5, you have to look at teaching children the German Shepherd commands. What are the, this is like very irreverent, I know, but it's like, what are the German Shepherd commands? What do you teach German Shepherd to do?
Sit.
Stay. What else?
Come.
No.
Talk.
No.
Just talk.
It's the opposite of talk. It's quiet.
You're not gonna have a very good happy watchdog.
All right. You need to teach children the German Shepherd commands. I get scared when I'm working with a 13-year-old who has not been taught the German Shepherd commands. Okay? This is also the limit setting here that goes in that needs to take place. If this doesn't take place, what happens? You have a child that's very much out of control, very much that feeling of entitlement. You're supposed to do what I want. That's your job. You're my mother. You're my father. That's what happens when this is not taught. You know, there's a lot of kids in the neighborhood that come around to the house and stuff, and I'm doing a lot of this with them. You know, some of these guys are going to be bigger than me soon. But it's like, you know, I teach them manners. You know, it's amazing. You know, 10 to 13-year-old teaching them manners. You know, when they come over and we're doing stuff and we work out in the garage or something, making stuff out of wood, and it's time to go. I say, guys, you forgot something. And they're looking around for what thing they forgot. And it's like they're still having a hard time catching on. Oh, yeah, thanks, Pete. You know, and then they're off. I said, that's right. That's good manners, guys. That's how you do things. They weren't taught that back here. Okay, so we're up to about 5-year-olds. Now we're going to go up to... Okay. About 6 to 9-year-olds. Skill or mastery. It's where they're beginning to realize that their bodies and their brains are capable of what? Almost unlimited stuff sometimes. You know, I love listening to kids, you know, their imagination sometimes, the things they come up with and what they want to do. All right? This is when they're starting to do that. Our society is very much geared towards sports in this area, which unfortunately leaves out people and, you know, children that are more on the creative side. And although we are heading more in that direction at times, of people that like to use the creative side of them and expressing themselves, as opposed to having to do it the skill way with, like, you know, playing soccer or sports. And so that's what you have to work at doing then with your kids then, is finding ways for them to feel skillful or having some mastery over something, becoming an expert at something. You know, it's like kids that don't feel this, what I work with the parents are doing is finding ways for them to do that. And even to the point where I like, okay, well, get, you know, all your kid does is play Nintendo. All right, well, do you ever play Nintendo with them? I don't know how to play. I said, get your child to teach you. Okay? The mastery type of stuff. Okay. So, 6, 9, all right. Relationships, and that's like about 10 to 13, somewhere there. Relationships are going on all through here, of course, but this is where much more so it is happening outside of the family and in areas where you're having less and less influence and control. Also, where your child is realizing that, and they may have realized this before, that you aren't always right.
You
know,
age 3.
friends of mine are like with their daughter Rachel, who's 7 now. And, you know, her response is, "Yeah, right." Like, you know, a 7-year-old, like, Rachel. She's like, you know, she said with this little grin in her. Yeah, you know, it's like she's such a charmer. You know, but so the relationships that occur in here. Being able to relate to other people. This is where you begin to see the fruits of all this stuff. All right? When you have a kid that at times is driving you batty, and you hear from the parents of your kids' friends, Your child is so wonderful to have at her house. Such manners. Always says thank you and please and is helpful. And you're like,
who are they?
You heard this, right?
Yes.
Okay? You know what that means? You're doing a wonderful job.
But why aren't they like that with you?
Because at home is the place where you can be whoever you are. You don't have to put on any kind, you don't have to follow the rules, you don't have to put on any pretense, you're just yourself.
So
in all your glory.
Are they really good people?
Now, think for yourself. You've then created a space where your child can just be. Now, this is the same space where your child, like someone was saying, you know, wants their back scratched even though they're still 14. Mm-hmm. Or when they're frightened, will cuddle up next to you. This is the same space you're creating now, okay? It's all the same space. And children very much need that space. Okay? Yeah.
Is that because they trust you so much they can do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'll love them anyway, even though they...
Warts and all.
They act terribly.
That's right. What is that? Say it again.
That's all they are, Daddy, just
warts.
Yes. Yeah. And where's your gray hair? Where's your gray hair?
Everything possible.
My former pastor back in North Carolina, their son, their oldest child, was a challenge from, like, you know, 13 on. And there were times that Shane would spend the weekend with me, either his choice or his parents' choice for him. And Shane and I, we got along just fine. And I was remodeling my own house at the time, and so, you know, he'd always help out. And, you know, it was really good for, you know, I got some help and working on the house, and he got a break from his parents and doing stuff that he enjoys doing. So then he was like, you know, and he had numerous problems throughout high school and all. But then the last 3 or 4 months of high school, it was like, he blossomed. It was like, you know, all the warts kind of just fell off. And I was talking to his mom, you know, after he went off to college, and she was so sad. And she goes, I worked so hard. You know, doing all this stuff. And she did. I said, I worked so hard. And he was such a pain to live with. And then he became this wonderful person. And then he moved away. When do I get to enjoy him? That kind of stuff. Yeah. And she's telling this to me. And it's like, you know, and knowing Shane, I'm beginning to feel it some here, but not to the degree that she does. Not nearly. Yeah. So, you know, all this kind of stuff is going on. Okay, and then we get to age 14 on separation, individuation, realizing what began back here is revisited, going off on their own, realizing that they are not you. For them to realize this, that yes, they're part of your family, but they are going to be getting out on their own and figuring out what they're going to be doing. Like I was saying earlier, you know, you always, always, always ask kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? You always ask them that question. And this is where they start to practice some things as they're starting to get older, their interests and what they want to do. And this is where it becomes your job in helping them to develop those interests that may change frequently. And so it's, you know, that's trying to get them then out on their own. Like what I tell you that with Shane, getting him to the point where the warts do hopefully fall off before he leaves the house. That's the idea. Okay? Yeah, huh, that's right. Easier said than done. Okay. Any questions on this so far? Yeah.
comment.
Yeah.
We were sitting on the porch just when we talked about some of this stuff, and we decided that maybe it's better to say you want to do when you grow up. Because the, it sounds like maybe you're going to turn into something else. Or we also don't want to define people as what they do in their job.
Yeah, right. What they do. That doesn't necessarily mean a job. I mean, do you want to, you know.
But what you want to be is still like you're not going to be yourself. You're going to be this other thing. It's going to be a fireman. It's not like I'm going to be me fighting fires.
Yeah. And yeah, I hear what you're saying. I'm not sure if it's us adults that are differentiating that.
Probably.
And if kids.
I always hated that question. It confused me my whole life.
Yeah.
What am I going to be? Obviously, I'm going to be me, but I'm going to be grown up.
Hopefully.
You're still working on that one. Yeah.
I guess I have a.
Sure.
I don't know. I guess we call it a concern rather than a question.
All right.
But the trust and the earlier separation issues, what about when a divorce happens in a family and the children are at those younger ages? How does that shake or affect their trust and their separation? And then how does that reverberate through the rest of their childhood?
There's a book, Grown Up Divorce, by Linda Frankel, can't remember offhand, that goes through the various stages as far as when divorce occurs and what are some of the typical reactions of children. You can see how when it occurs here, that trust is the major issue. Mm-hmm. You know, because you know, this is what you know I have had, and now it's changed. And so this gets shaken, definitely. You know, is it going to affect them the rest of their life? It depends on how the adults deal with the trust issues at this age. And if they specifically address the trust issues. If the parents are too much caught up in the divorce and their own issues, and because the child behaves, quote unquote, and they don't deal with this stuff, yes, it's going to significantly affect them from here on. Yeah.
How about something like, okay, you've got a divorce occurring, we happen to be in a blended family, mm-hmm. and you have different messages from the divorced parents, and one parent doesn't come up with the German Shepherd commands. They are the indulgent parent, and the other parent is trying to set standards. Well, how does that reverberate on up, especially in the teen years when you've got them then saying...
At what age?
They go through the separation. They're right, yeah, in around 5 and 6, right in there.
Okay.
But now they're teens.
Now they're 12, 16, and 20.
Right. All right, so if they did not get this, if they didn't learn this stuff back then, it makes it extremely difficult, and especially trying to do it in the teenage years, you're going to get the kind of stuff like, well, you didn't tell me.
And you quoted my daughters when you said, you're my dad, you're supposed to give me all these things. I mean, that's exactly what they said.
Yeah, feeling of entitlement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Some of that can also, if it's coming out of divorce, some of that can also come from hurt and anger.
And then the parent deals with the guilt of the divorce and those issues, and they play into each other, and
right.
It gets really...
So if your child is hurt and is still reeling from the hurt, the way you're going to see that typically in from here on up is in anger. Yeah.
In your first session, you gave us separations of ages, where you know what happens with these kids and why they react the way they do. I have a grandson who is 5 years old, and his parents are divorced, and so he's got. One of the things you said there was too many caregivers. You know, that cause perhaps some behavioral problems. And I think maybe that's the key there is, like my daughter now is trying to work with her ex-husband and his wife and trying to get set definite guidelines that they are going to agree on if they can, because he's at the tantrum frantic stage where he has too many caregivers.
Yeah, and what you see in them is that they feel unsafe.
That's right, and then he's reacting accordingly to what a five-year-old would
sure.
be from not yeah. feeling that yeah. trust.
But, you know, I also see kids able to adjust to different situations pretty, it's amazing to me. Sometimes you can, I work full-time, my kids go to grade school, and they're also in a daycare situation. They're also with my parents and us, and they adjust. They know what different expectations are. They figure that out very quickly. It's amazing to me. They know the rules in certain places.
If they've got this foundation, yes.
Yeah,
but you can see that sometimes with some children, it's difficult. You get a real colicky baby. This is hard to do.
It's very mm-hmm. hard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very hard. I'm an obstetrical nurse, and I'm working with parents, and
yeah.
it can really, you
right.
can understand
yeah.
sometimes violence.
Well, I was just going to say, a lot of times you see what happens with the divorces you get. The custodial parent is the heavy, and you know, it's like good cop, bad cop, you know, and then the child is getting such different messages as they don't work together that they play it against, you know,
yeah.
for their own benefit too.
Yeah.
And a lot of that just, I think, maybe has to do with how we, you know, change our attitudes towards divorce and, you know, that has to do with how the parents
yes.
Child.
Yeah. And again, this is where I say you have to kind of go back and look and see, you know, how much trust was developed. You know, I started with one like 15 years, this was years ago, and this was developed, came into here, and it was a divorce. And you're talking about very different families. Mom and dad still lived in the same community. You go back and forth, but it was really confusing for them. And so that, you know, too many rules, not enough rules kind of stuff, and the anger was coming out, and the intensity of the anger just got angrier and angrier and angrier. Mm-hmm. Until finally, you know, they, you know, got them into therapy, and I was working with them. And what we kind of do is we go back to the hurt that he felt back here. He said no one, and it took a while to get him to verbalize this, no one understood how sad I was when my parents divorced. And so I asked him, I said, well, what do you want to do about that? I said, well, I want them to know. Well, this was in North Carolina. His dad lived in the Midwest, and his mom was in Charlotte. And I said, well, let's get them all together. And he goes, really? I said, so we did. And I called and I talked to his dad, asked him if he'd be willing to come down. His father said, absolutely. Now, the message that his dad gave me, it wasn't getting through to his son that absolutely he'd come down. His son, like, my dad won't come down. And so one of the things we had to work through is helping the son understand how the father really felt, and vice versa, and for the son to express to his parents how hurtful this was, and for his parents not to give any excuses, but just to listen. It was amazing what we were able to work through, but it was because this was developed that made the difference. It's when the trust is not there, that's when it gets really difficult. Yeah.
I'm an elementary school counselor, and we have kids sign up for divorce groups. It's amazing the number of them that the divorce happened preschool. And the parents will say, why do they keep signing up for divorce groups? The kid's fifth grade now. Why does he keep, you know, this, every year you offer this group, and he's been in a divorce group since kindergarten. You know, aren't you, haven't you fixed him yet? And it's sort of like, you know, what the kids keep saying is they still are locked down, usually at whatever level they were at the time of the divorce. They're having trouble with their friendships, they're having trouble feeling good about themselves, they're having trouble feeling that they will ever be happy.
Yeah.
Because they are, and they're angry. Many of these are really, you know, they may not sign up for divorce, but they'll sign up for anger management.
Yeah.
But when you get them, you know, why are you angry, it always reverts back.
This father I've been working with, and he announced that, well, his wife and I finally decided they're going to get divorced. And I asked about his kids, and oh, I said, oh, you know, they're resilient, they'll be able to, you know, manage and everything. And then he thought for a few minutes, he goes, do you really think this is going to affect them a lot? And my answer to him is that this event will change their lives forever. And he, like, looked at me like,
have you found a strong correlation between divorce situations and, say, an adoptee? I mean, some child that has been adopted, do they have those hurts or something, either consciously or unconsciously, to where you have the same behavior patterns that you're talking about?
I think that when a child is adopted, a lot of it depends a whole lot on the age they're adopted at, how the family has worked with them on it, and you know the child's reaction to it. You know, kids that grow up in the family knowing that they are adopted, and the whole attitude of them being adopted was that, you know, we wanted you to be part of our family. And that, yes, you do have a biological mom and dad that's out there that we don't know about. You know, and for some kids, they kind of like, okay, you know, it's no big deal. And for some kids, it's like, you know, you mean you're not my real mom and dad? You know, and it's, so you have to determine each kid how they're going to be dealing with this. So it varies a great deal. So what your question was then with divorce, though?
Well, I was just wondering if an adoptee may have the same hurts and everything because of an adoption. So would it be comparable?
I think that with children that are adopted, as they get older, for some of them, it becomes more of an issue. At a younger age, it doesn't seem to be that much of an issue for them. Again, depending if they grow up knowing that they're adopted. So that if they're told from here on, you know, that they are adopted and this is the story of how we got you, and they're told this story repeatedly, they grow up knowing that this is who they are.
Yeah. I'll just tell a little story about my family. Our children are adopted, okay? Huh? One is going to be 38, 37 this month, and the other is 39. And we adopted them as babies, okay? And they were always told from the moment they were adopted. And there came a point when they noticed that their auntie was pregnant, and they didn't quite understand, you know, this type of thing. So I sat them down, and one was about 3 and the other was about 5. And I can still remember them sitting on the steps, and I told them that they were not in my uterus, being a nurse, that's the way I have to talk, and that they had a mother and a father that we didn't know but loved them dearly. And our little girl, the oldest one, one silent tear went down her face. And she's that kind of personality still at 39. And you don't know exactly what her feelings are. But our little boy, who is now, he's a different personality, put his hands on his hips and he said, "I know I've been adopted, but was I born?" I'm not sure adopted is the right word. You were born to, you have a birth mother. Settled at age 3.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Yeah.
So kind of coming off that, I'm still back on the German Shepherd speaking.
Gotcha.
Where's the communication skills that they learn? You have to teach them to express their needs in a way that other people can understand in order to have met, otherwise you get stuck. I'm just going to throw my father at this. In the temper tantrum stage, I had a hard time learning how to communicate my needs properly because I was raised with my parents who couldn't. So it's not just teaching them what not to do, it's teaching them how to do certain things the right way. So
gotcha. Again, I want you to appreciate my artwork. Those years of art school to do this.
We're not with the auction yet.
Very joyful.
I was bidding on that painting.
Sell it with a can of Diet Coke and I'll go for lunch.
All right. Yeah. This is where the communication aspect of it comes in. And being able to effectively communicate with someone is one of the toughest things I know of, and is probably 90% of my job. Basically, we have a person here who is some kind of a message. And that message can be verbal. It can be the look. It can be... Y'all get these when you had kids? finger, so I can kind of stuff. It can be lots of different things, but some kind of a message that goes across. And the message could be as simple as, like, back here, when you have a baby that needs to be held, and you hold that child. And what a wonderful message you are communicating to an infant at that point. Okay? And then you get some kind of feedback. Okay? So feedback comes over and it kind of lets you know what your message was that got across. So with the child then, with this need here, if they just need to be held and you hold them, the feedback you get is the child and just kind of cuddle up and just melt in your arms kind of stuff. Or if they continue to scream, maybe it's their diaper that needs to be changed, or they're hungry, they're giving you feedback, letting you know what's going on. Now, as they get older, you know, that feedback becomes more verbal. And sometimes it doesn't always come out in nice ways. What was it? We were on the hike the other day, and you know, one of our friends was whining. You know, no whining kind of stuff, you know, that's the feedback we're getting. Kids are good at that sometimes. We model whining a lot of times for our kids and how we communicate. But you always do get that feedback. Now, the difficulty that comes in with the communication is that there always are these roadblocks or filters to the communication. It can be, for example, my communicating to you this morning. The message I'm trying to get across to you can be filtered by lots of different things. It can be filtered by my own attitude. Okay? Well, I really didn't want to be here this week. I really wanted to be in Hawaii on vacation kind of stuff. And so I've got kind of this attitude, and so I'm coming across with an edge to what I'm saying to you. So the message I'm trying to communicate maybe isn't getting across the way that I think I should get across. And so the feedback I'm getting to you is that only one or two people show up for these workshops. Right? And I'm like, well, where is everybody? What is this? Alright? Another filter could be, it's a gorgeous day outside. Y'all could be hiking right now. Or just sitting out in the sun. That can be a filter. One of your children might be sick. Or you're not quite sure what they're doing right now. And you're just wondering, I wonder if they're okay. You know, stuff that's going on back at home. Another filter. So it affects you hearing the message and also the feedback coming back and forth. So as far as how do you help a child then communicate, what you do is you just try and structure it so that when they do communicate that you're listening. You know, it's like, how often does, you know, a child go up to a parent and the parents, you know, and the child's talking, go, yeah, go ahead, I'm listening, you know, kind of stuff. And the child is getting the message that you're not listening because about 90% of communication is not spoken. It is by the non-verbal communication. So we may think that what we're saying, most of it's getting across. No. Now, this is why I'm doing all this stuff, because if you add another component to just the verbal, visual, a lot more of the information gets stuck in. It also helps me organize what I'm trying to do. So it makes more sense sometimes when I'm doing it this way.
So do you start that like around 3 to 5 age? I mean, I assume the baby just cries, right?
So yeah.
Just needs and stuff, so it cries.
But if I talk to that baby, mm-hmm. I've talked to my kids since before they were born. Mm-hmm. And now I'm a father and mother with my own. I talked to my kids since before I was born, and now I have 2 that just...
So what age is that?
Well, my son's 2.5 and my daughter's 4.5, and they can carry on a conversation mm-hmm. together and keep each other entertained.
So I said number 1.5, 2.
Well, but you start communicating way before that with a child.
Right, yeah.
The visual, remember the non-verbal, is much more important than the verbal. So when you have a child that comes into a room and they have this kind of look on their face, they don't have to say anything. As a parent, you can kind of guess something's not right. And so, as a parent, do you go say, what's wrong? You know? And your child is like, no. All right? Nothing. All right? How often do you hear that? Nothing. You know, when you know there is something wrong going on, but your child is like, you know, you're trying to communicate what? caring, concern, and your child is receiving it as being intrusive, or you're interfering, or that it's scary what you're trying to do. It's like it's too much. So how can you get a message of being caring to a child who maybe is not as verbal as your kids? Because lots of kids are that way. How is it you can kind of communicate to them that you're concerned about them without words?
Putting your arms around them, touching them.
For some children, putting your arm around and touching them, yes. What else?
Eye contact.
The eye contact sometimes, yeah. Getting down at their level. I spend sometimes most of my days on the floor. You know, people, my good pants always, their knees, they're shiny.
Just like the kids.
If I want to be able to communicate with kids, sitting in, you know, in chairs all the time kind of stuff, just doesn't cut it. Okay? Yeah?
Well, I think the hardest thing for me is helping children with anger and how to communicate anger in ways that's acceptable.
Appropriate.
I mean, my preteen just gets in this rage sometimes and he can't get out. And when he was little, I could just cuddle him until the tantrum was gone. But I can't physically do that anymore. And that's been the most challenging thing the last year for me is I want him to be able to express anger because I grew up at home and we didn't do that well.
Yeah.
So it's scary now when I see this incredible rage coming out of this child.
And where can you start actively dealing with that?
Okay.
I mean, aside from example, right? You can always provide an example.
Yeah, how you deal with your own rage is one thing. But also, yeah, I mean, you know, for children to be able, for your children to express those kind of feelings at home says a lot for the atmosphere you create in your home. Because some kids don't feel safe to express any feelings. All right, so you got this rage coming out. It's kind of like exploding all over the place. Well, one of the things is to try and deal with it when they're not rageful. Okay? You know, beforehand and or afterwards, talking about, all right, now you know how angry you got before. And like how you wanted to do this or that kind of stuff, or how you broke the window or kicked the door or whatever it might be. What are some things that you can do when you get that intensely angry? Because we all get that angry. And then you talk about how you get that angry at times. You know, what do you do then when you get that angry? You know, are you turning it all inwards? And is that what you want your child to do? Or, you know, I give kids like on note cards sometimes, you know, steps to do when they're angry to carry with them in school. So kind of remind them, because when they start to get in that cycle, they're not thinking. And if you can remind them, you know, look, you know, what does it say to do when you get angry? I know what it says, you know, kind of stuff, you know, and then they go and look. Because remember, they're angry. So it's like, you know, you're going to get that kind of response to them. And, you know, oh, okay, I'm going to, and then they go do it kind of stuff with this attitude, but they do it. And so a lot of it is the teaching aspect of it. And the other thing is to look at that anger is, let's see, anger is a secondary feeling. Mm-hmm. 99.99% of the time, I'm guessing, there's feelings before the anger. Hurt. Being embarrassed, you know, feeling shame.
Insecurity.
Yeah.
Feeling insecure.
Whole lot of stuff. Frustration. Okay? That goes on before the anger. The more you can deal with this here, the less you're going to get here. Yeah.
I feel like with the number of children that you have to deal with anger. It seems like the number of adults that are angry is increasing.
This whole idea of road rage, mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
It's one of the only feelings we're allowed to have.
It's the only feeling we're allowed to have, and it's an acceptable feeling in our society to be angry. You know, it's you're driving down the road and someone cuts in front of you. It's acceptable to give them the finger, to honk your horn, to yell at them, whatever kind of stuff. But is it appropriate to pull over and to cry because it scared you so much what they did?
I was just going to say, the emotions are fine. It's how we act on this.
The behaviors. When we deal with an adolescent, they're all kind of mushed together. And so to help people, yeah, that's part of the teaching then, is helping to realize that, yeah, it's okay for you to get angry at me. It's okay for you to hate me. But it's not okay for you to hit me when you're feeling those feelings towards me. You can write them down. You can draw them. You can stomp on the floor. You can go out and you can chop wood. You can, I mean, you know, want to ride your bicycle, you know, whatever it might be. You want to get the helmet on. It's like, you know, but the idea is, yeah, it's all, a lot of it is teaching.
I was just going to say that in my life, I had a lot of anger. I've learned how to control it until. But what I went to was the scriptures, to look at Christ's examples. He does say, yes, it's all right to be angry. Mm-hmm. But then what do you do with that anger?
Yeah.
But in his life, many times he was spit upon and whatever. And the only time that you can see that he got really angry was at the money changers.
Yeah, in the temple.
And so the example to me was from that, and this is just my own learning, which really changed my anger type of thing, was that question yourself, Shirley, as to, is your anger coming because you have been hurt, or is it because it's okay for you to be angry if somebody else is injured or hurt? And that's Christ's example.
Yeah.
And he did become angry at his father's house.
I'm curious, at what age in your life did that transformation occur?
Probably late 30s.
Okay.
A long time.
All right.
A long time.
So, and that's where you kind of look at, you know, what are the realistic expectations of teenagers?
Mm-hmm. A long time.
Okay. If we were to... what are some words that you would use to describe preteen teenagers?
What, middle school? Is that what you
mean? Middle school on up, yeah.
Self-centered.
Defiant.
Insecure.
Defiant. What's the last one?
Insecure. Energetic.
Friend-centered.
Fun. Yeah.
Wait. Was it
friend-centered?
Helpful.
Helpful?
Creative? Idealistic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Compassionate?
Inquisitive.
Along with that idealistic, they have a very well-defined sense of what's fair and what's not.
Fairness.
Okay.
Still very needing to be cuddled. Mm-hmm.
And I think at that age, they always feel less than.
They always feel what?
Less than. They're less than an adult. They're less than a, you know.
They're more older than a less than. Than
yeah, they're
awkward.
I think the word is asynchronous, that some of them are developing, one side of the body is developing at a different time than the other side, but I also see in my own 13-year-old that the body and the mind are not in sync at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They go through these growth spurts where they're, you know, they've got like a size 13 feet, mm-hmm. and they're tripping over everything because they're not used to having, yeah.
It's a little self-conscious.
Oh yeah.
Kind of spacey.
Moody.
They can be very intelligent too, but they don't. Sometimes they don't let themselves
be. What was the last
name? Very intelligent.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times people don't listen to them. They're
Really kind of stuck in it.
I was I gave a talk at a youth convention, and I was saying how children, you know, youth are the church of today. Maybe they're saying youth are the church of the future, and I was disagreeing with that, and was literally yelled at in front of this, all these teenagers by the bishop, because I was disagreeing that, you know, well, who am I to say that the youth are the church of today? You know, they're the future leaders, you know, kind of stuff. I know I wasn't supposed to disagree with the bishop there, but anyway. Yeah, not giving credit. A movie, October Sky. If you have any pre-adolescents, especially boys, I mean, this is a movie about, you know, having this dream. And it's just a wonderful movie to take kids to. It's wonderful. Yeah, not given credit for how smart they are and how much they know. Great movie. What else movies? Sensitive.
I'm aware of their physical self, looking in the mirror all the time.
Self-conscious.
Yeah, the self-conscious.
Every damn place.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in some ways, really enjoying this change also. I mean, my fortune, I was grown 8 inches this year. He's
still. How much taller is he than you?
He's about 9 inches taller.
Okay.
I'd say it's like monoprospective. They're intelligent, but they only have one perspective. Very limited perspective.
Yeah, it's judgmental. I guess we don't have that up there.
Well, maybe tying into the single perspective is an arrogance. And sometimes that comes to, because of the intelligence and that they've gotten really involved in something and they know, or they're convinced they know, far more about that topic than anyone else. It's kind of what you said about you didn't know you weren't supposed to argue with the bishop. And I remember correcting a teacher in home ec in junior high and being sent to the office because that was not appropriate. Even though I was right, she was wrong. And, but I think there are a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And how much do we give credit for? You know, I've got one adolescent that I'm working with now. He's got his IQ is astronomical. I'm guessing. I mean, just by in my interactions with him about how bright he is. And I told him, I said, you know, well, frankly, you know, you are smarter than me. You know, intelligence-wise. I said, but you don't know what the heck to do with your feelings. And he feels so bad inside. You know, he can write about it, but still doesn't stop him from feeling suicidal. I said, I can teach you how to deal with your feelings. I said, you could teach me all day about the stuff that you know that I don't know. So somewhere in between, you know, we can find out how to work together. And we have. But acknowledging that he's smarter than me, you know, it was like, I said, you know, how many teachers admit that you're smarter than them? I said, what, are you crazy? He was like, you know, yeah.
Well, yeah, adults often, you know, treat young children of that age like, you know, they can't even get waited on. They stand in line, they wait on the person
behind
them. You know, they it's very difficult for them to be recognized as a person.
Yes.
That's not a child anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they're seen as threatening.
Yes.
I mean, my daughter's been told by shopkeepers, if you're not in here to buy something, please leave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
how many adults do they tell that to?
Yeah. A loitering teenager is a problem. Out of here.
Yeah. No wonder the gray hair going bald. I mean, look at the stuff that you're dealing with. You know, it is such a mixed bag at times. It's, you know, in many ways, I'm really lucky because when I get working with kids, they're the ones that are having the difficulty. And I work at being able to communicate, you know, how is it that I can communicate with someone who doesn't necessarily want to be in my office? And, you know, it's, yeah, I don't have to tell them to pick up their clothes and make their bed. No, I have that luxury. But the key of the communication with someone who's like this is finding a way for your child that works. For a lot of parents, it's at bedtime. For some, it's first thing in the morning. For some, it's anything but first thing in the morning. You know, for some, it might be while you're driving in the car. For others, you know, whatever it might be. This one guy came to my office, and he couldn't put into words what he was thinking. And I had this, you know, one of those giant koosh balls. And so, you know, I tossed him this koosh ball, and he was just playing with it. And something clicked. And he's like a senior in high school, and he just started talking. And then when we were getting to the end of us working together, and he had worked through his issues, and he was ready to kind of move on with his life, I always kind of like give something, you know, some kind of transitional object. So I wrapped up the koosh ball and I gave it to him. And he sat there with these tears streaming down his face. And I said, that's to help you talk to everyone else now. Find a way to help kids be able to talk then. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm just going to ask a question out of ignorance here.
It's okay.
Because I'm not a parent. I'm thinking about being a parent.
Yeah, and then we're past time actually, but. So feel free to, if you need to go, but ask your question. I want to stay here.
So I look at this board and I see all of those things in myself and in my husband. And I'm wondering, what's the real difference between being a parent and just having a relationship with somebody that you love? Right? I mean, even with between him and I, we set boundaries. I mean, he's a little bit better trained than my kid will be.
I'll let you talk to some of the other parents.
Well,
you can't
train.
Mine
is trained, right? But I'm not really sure that I see what the difference is.
You'll find out.
I do think that if you deeply respect your child, you respect them at the level they're at. But if you speak respectfully to a two-year-old, and you've always spoken respectfully since they were prenatal, you receive back what you model. If my daughter had a birth defect with her foot, and I didn't want her to grow up thinking that foot was ugly, and so I purposely talked about her talented toes as she was little, and never ever, you know, we went to the doctor a lot with her foot, but we always talked about those talented toes and how they were, you know, and so I never said they're just as good as anybody else's. I just talked about that they were good,
right?
And I think this is what you feed in. If even when you see a deficit your child has, you put a positive spin on it before they get a chance to get them.
But don't you want to do the same thing with your husband or your best friend too?
Yeah. Only it's the neat thing is with your own child, you get the preset, you know, their view on it.
Right.
You don't have to wait to let the world damage them and try to pick them back up again. You get to kind of get that 0 to 3 trust build, and then, you know, you're going to work with the damage the rest of the world does later. But
I was going to say, your husband or your best friends have a history of years and years of living, and your child comes out as a clean slate, and there's a difference there. You can't just assume that they know anything. They don't know anything. So there's a difference there. And it's an awesome responsibility to consider you are there to take care of them and teach them. And
but yet your relationship with them.
Mm-hmm, yeah, those qualities of relationship are important that you're talking about, and I think they're valid.
I mean, it's just like I said, I mean, when I look at that board, you know, I see everyone I know. I see who are moody and self-conscious and energetic and fun. And
but your relationship with your child goes through many more stages, I think, than a relationship. More abrupt and more wide-ranging changes from that 0 to 3 to that 3 to 5 to that. I mean, every relationship changes over the years, but the relationship there, I mean, it changes astronomically from 0 to 18 or 21 or...
And it can be very frightening, because you can be a good parent to a 3 to 5 year old and then all of a sudden reach a stage where you say, how come my parenting skills aren't successful anymore? Yeah. I've got this different person who has an attitude or whatever, and I did all that loving and nurturing. We have to grow as parents all the way along, and that's the ongoing challenge. You can be successful at a certain level and then say, okay, it's time for me to grow, especially when they get to the teen thing. And it's like, what's this curfew stuff? Don't you trust me? You know, you get all this stuff flung back at you with this edge in it, and you might want to put the edge on it and come right back at them, and then you have to say, wait a minute, what am I modeling? How do I diffuse the situation? And it was stuff you didn't have to do with the 2, 5, 7, 9 year old. So you're going to be called forth to do new things as they go into new stages.
And if you kind of keep in mind that your relationship with your husband, your friends, is a mutual relationship. That's how it began, and that's how it's going to continue.
Right.
You are there for your child, and it is not a mutual relationship most of the time.
But you're going to have a similar relationship with, like, my grandmother who just had heart surgery. So I was in a caregiver situation with them.
Right, but we're talking about up until, like, you know, through the teenage years, it is like, it is not mutual. You know, it's like, you know.
You give more.
That's right. It is most times one-sided. Yeah. You giving much more than you ever get back.